If you're newer to One Harbor, we go through books of the Bible, and we're in a series right now going through a book of the Bible called 1 Corinthians. It's called 1 Corinthians because it's one of two letters, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and it's written to this church in a place called Corinth, hence Corinthians. And, you know, one of the things, if you read through the book of 1 Corinthians, if you were going to say, hey, should this church exist or not exist, I think overwhelmingly we'd read this book and go, these guys should probably get shut down because they are a mess. Right? And so as we've read through this, that's what we decided to call it, messy church, because we're getting to see the Corinthians were a total mess in a lot of different ways. But Paul writes to them, he says, look, I can see God at work in the midst of your mess. God's doing some stuff with you guys. He's using you. There's different ways where you're actually doing okay. Every other ways where you're excelling, but man, there's some areas that you need to work on. And for us, as we read through books like this as Christians, I know that not all of us in the room are Christians, but for those of us who are, you know, we're not meant to read this like we're trying to get the right answers on a quiz. Like, this isn't like history class. This is us going, okay, they were a mess, but we're a mess. I mean, if you're new to One Harbor and you thought, you know, I'm going to pick this church because this is the one that doesn't have any mess. Let me enlighten you. We got some. We got some drama, right? We have mess in here because people are messy. And churches are just people. And so that mess that they had, Paul says, look, the gospel can help you with that. And if the gospel can help them, the gospel can help us. And that's why we're going through this. And this morning's passage, what Paul really gets into is there's different ways of thinking. He thinks differently than they think. And that's what's driving a lot of what's going on with them, right? A lot of the mess that's happening, it's coming because their minds are screwed up. Their minds are thinking differently. And we're going to see this morning that Paul thinks really different to them. And that makes all the difference. But what we'll also see, I think you're going to see like I see, is that not only does he think different to them, he thinks different to us. What Paul says that goes through his head when he thinks about himself, when he thinks about others, is very different to what's normal for us in our society. A pastor named Tim Keller, who leads a church or led a church up in New York, he actually wrote a book about this passage. And what we're going to say this morning is largely influenced by that book because it was so dynamically helpful for me. In fact, I wouldn't encourage you to do what I did. I read it on a plane next to a very large man, and I cried a lot. And it was not good for me, but it made me grow in humility. I really hope that this morning this can help you because it's helped me a lot. And so let's go through it together. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1 through 6, Paul says this. This is how one should regard us. This is how I want you to think about me. Think about us as your leaders, as servants of Christ, as stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I am not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light these things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. I have applied all these things to myself and to Apollos. This is the other leader that they kept trying to compare Paul to, and they were all doing this division thing. He says, I'm applying this to me and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written. This is the key, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another. Essentially, what Paul's talking about is what we would refer to in our day as self-esteem or ego, right? And this is something that we've, you know, probably thought about some or read about some. Some of us may more than others, but all of us have this conscious sort of, you know, or subconscious, we're always thinking about ourselves, you know, and our self-esteem and self-talk and our ego and all the rest. And I think probably we would all admit that we've got some self-esteem problems, you know, but what Paul says, he paints a very different picture than what is typically talked about when it comes to our self-esteem. And so I want us to consider something just as we begin to think about this. Consider, is good self-esteem really the answer to everything, right? Over the last 50 years, this has kind of been what we've heard regarding self-esteem is that you have to have really good self-esteem if you want to be have a positive life. And if you have really bad self-esteem, it's going to be very dangerous for you and everybody around you. And so much of sort of American psychiatry has said it's dangerous to think too little of yourself, and a positive self-image is the key to good behavior, that your behavior is determined by how you view yourself is essentially what we've heard for the last 50 years. And the thought goes like this, that low self-esteem is the reason why people, you know, act out in crimes like, you know, substance abuse and prostitution or murder or rape. And That these bad things are really just people acting out because they want to feel better about themselves. And if they just felt more firm, they wouldn't do these bad things, right? This is kind of the line of thought that we've heard for the last 50 or so years. The problem is it doesn't seem to be true. It doesn't seem to be true. Our self-esteem scores in our country are off the charts. They're higher than they've ever been. And you know what else is also higher than it's ever been? This opioid pandemic. And so if we're also happy and positive, why are we also medicated and addicted? Something doesn't seem to be adding up. Don't take my word for it, but let's look. There's an article that the New York Times came out with a while ago, The Trouble with Self-Esteem. And the person in the article had reviewed a lot of the latest self-esteem research, and they said this: people with high self-esteem pose a greater threat to those around them than people with low self-esteem. That is so backwards to everything that we've heard. High self-esteem, you're more dangerous. And feeling bad about yourself is not the cause of our country's biggest and most expensive social problems. They're saying high self-esteem is more dangerous than low self-esteem. One social scientist said it like this: the fact is, we've put antisocial men through every self-esteem test we have, and there is no evidence for the old psychodynamic concept that they secretly feel bad about themselves. These men are racist or violent because they don't feel bad enough about themselves. It's interesting, and I'm not saying you're all going to believe me at this stage in it, but I hope by the end of the morning we've helped you with some thought on this, because it really was controversial to me at first, but it's helped me. It seems like the social scientists and it seems like Paul somewhat agree that our greatest problem is not thinking too little of ourselves. That doesn't seem to be our greatest problem. We don't all just need a big hug and everything will be better, just some affirmation and everything will be better. If we just were encouraged, we wouldn't do the bad things that we do. So what's the real problem? You can't fix it if you don't know the problem, right? Well, in verse 6, we're going to start at verse 6 and we'll kind of work our way back up towards the beginning of the passage. Paul begins to get at the real problem. Verse 6, he says, I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn from us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up. That puffed up, that's the problem. Our problem is that our egos are puffed up. It comes from a Greek word which means to blow, and figuratively it means to blow up or to inflate. And really, it's getting at like an organ of the human body, right? That's distended. It's got so much air that's been pumped into it that it's ready to burst. It's overinflated. It's swollen. It's inflamed because it's been extended past its proper size. That's the picture Paul gives here. Like an organ in our body that's full of hot air. Our ego is puffed up. We've been puffed up, right? That's what's happening to their egos. They've been blown up. They're overinflated. And like with an organ, if that was to happen to your stomach, there would be implications. And there are implications. So first, let's just look at this idea of our egos being unnaturally inflated. You and I don't think about body parts typically in our body unless they hurt. I got like a little scrape on my ankle the other day. And it's like I can feel it right now in my shoe. But otherwise, I'm not walking around going like, man, what's a heck of an ankle? Love that ankle. You guys seen that ankle? Look at that ankle right there. I don't ever think about my ankle. I think about it right now because I've got a big old cut on the back of it, right? If your stomach aches, you think about your stomach. You're not normally going like, oh man, stomach. All right, you're doing good. Like no one thinks about those things, your headache, toothache. You don't ever think about your head or your teeth until they ache, right? We don't consciously think about stuff unless it's hurting. And in the same way, what's happening is our ego, like an organ, is drawing attention to itself because something's wrong with it. It's inflamed. And that inflammation is drawing our attention to it, okay? Why are we so concerned with what everyone thinks about us all the time? Think about it. Facebook, Instagram, it's just exacerbating the problem. Oh, they didn't like what I posted? I thought the meal looked really good. That picture, I had the right lighting and everything. What's not to like? Oh, you didn't like my photo of my dinner last night? Well, I'm not going to like your photo of your dinner. Like, what is going on with us? I got to say the right thing and take the right picture. And social media is just exacerbating this problem. So imagine you went to a doctor. Imagine there was a doctor for this kind of thing. And you went in and he said, okay, tell me what's wrong. And you said, it hurts. Okay, where does it hurt? What hurts when people talk about me? Okay, it hurts when people talk about you. What else? Does it hurt anywhere else? It hurts when people don't talk about me. Okay. Hurts when they do, hurts when they don't, all right? I got it. And you said, what else? I feel like it's my feelings that are hurting. It's my feelings. My feelings are hurt. The doctor would say, I don't think there's anything wrong with your feelings. I think there's a whole lot wrong with your ego. Because what's hurting is people talking about you or not talking about you. That's just your ego. Can't be talked about enough or talked about too much. And the doctor might write you a prescription and say something along the lines of this. Would you like to stay off social media for a while and blah, 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 you know, because it's exacerbating the problem. Like if you hurt your knee, you might say stay off of it for a while. We've got this problem with our ego because it's overinflated. It's drawing attention to itself. What's specifically causing the inflammation, doctor? Well, Paul gives us the specifics. He says our egos get inflated by comparing ourselves to other people. We're puffed up with competitiveness and comparison. We're like puffer fish. You know those fish that like blow up to like make themselves look bigger than they really are? But it's just hot air, you know? And they're like blowing themselves up, trying to look bigger than each other. And this whole like self-defense thing they do, that's what we're like. We're like puffer fish, inflating ourselves so we can hopefully deflate other people. I remember thinking about this. I was thinking about this and like, man, that reminds me of myself in middle school. And I was like, it kind of reminds me of myself in high school. Dang, I'm 36. It still kind of reminds me of myself. I thought this would get better. You know what gets better? Our ability to hide this kind of thing. It's so obvious when you're in middle school. No offense to you guys in middle school at all, because it's hard to be in middle school. But it's so hard to control these feelings. But as an adult, what you do is get better at hiding it, because it's not cool to let everybody know you think like that. But you still do. Constantly comparing ourselves. C.S. Lewis was an author. He said he really gets at what's driving this comparison is pride. It's our ego. This is what he says in Mere Christianity. He says, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. You can't enjoy a single thing because all you want is more than somebody else. He says, we say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they're not. Nope. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. That's what they're proud of. He says, imagine if everyone else became equally rich or clever or good looking, there'd be nothing to be proud of. It is the comparison that makes you proud. The pleasure of being above the rest. This is just brutal. A proud man will take your girl from you, not because he wants her, but just to prove to himself that he is a better man than you. That's what's driving us. This ego, this pride. We puff ourselves up and we do things we don't even enjoy just to feel better about ourselves. Got to do good things because I want to look good. Not because I want to be good, because I want to look good. Say smart things because I want to look smart and sound smart, not because I want to be smart. And maybe even do godly things because I want to look godly, not because I really care about what God thinks. See how this happens? Very subtle. Ego's in this constant struggle and calling attention to themselves, and they're overcompensating all the time, getting bigger and bigger. But like the fish, they can only get so big. And that's really the last thing we would see with this kind of word picture, if you will, of this overinflated organ. Our egos become dangerously inflated. They can only get so big. What happens to a balloon if you keep blowing air into it? Pop, right? And the deal is this, if you're inflated, you're in a lot of danger of being deflated. And that's this constant fear we deal with. Someone deflating us. We gotta stay feeling good about ourselves because we stack ourselves up against others. Inflation, inflation, inflation. Pop. Bubble gets busted. We realize someone else is better than us at something, and there's always somebody better than us at something. This roller coaster is one of pride and despair, pride and despair, pride and despair, and it's vicious, and it's very hard to get off of. And a lot of you in the room are probably on it right now. Relying on being puffed up, living off that feeling of being puffed up is a very fragile place to be because it's all just air. It takes the smallest little thing, little pinprick, pop. You're on top, now you're on the bottom. And so really what we'll see this morning is that what we don't need to do is be filled up by air. We need to be like filled up with something with some substance. You can't pop a brick. You can't pop a rock, you know? So we need to figure out what is it that can fill us up that's actually substantial. It's not so fickle. So the problem is our egos are inflated and they're drawing attention to themselves. But then it does lead to a result, and that result is just bad behavior. It's easy to miss this, but check it out in verse 3 and 4. Paul says, "With me it's a very small thing that I should even be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself." So the problem is our ego's overinflated. The result is that we viciously judge others and ourselves. So we're inflating our ego, and what do we turn into? Really judgmental people. We're always judging other people, and we're also always judging ourselves. We live in a constant state of judgment, which is exhausting. It's exhausting for our souls, and it's exhausting for the people around us. Always having to be at your best, always having to be at your best. What do I wear? You know, what should I do? What should I say? What picture should I post? You know, just that constant feeling, it's exhausting. Judging ourselves and judging others all the time. And so Paul does something interesting. He says, I'm not judged by a human court, which is kind of an odd thing because as far as we know, no one in the Corinthian church was suing Paul. You know, they weren't actually taking him to court. But Paul says, look, this is what it's like. It's like you've taken me to court. It's like you put me on trial and you want me to prove to you that I'm good enough for you or that I'm better than you. You put me up on the stand and you want me to prove myself. That's what you're making me do. I was in Superior Court this last week with my brother. And let me tell you, if you've never been there, it is an intimidating place. It's one of those places you want to get in and get out of, but they didn't take us till last. And so I was there all day. And I was ready to get out, man. I was uncomfortable watching moms cry as their sons went to prison, watching guilty people beg for mercy. I was ready to leave. Court is a tough environment. And Paul says, this is what you're doing to me. You're putting me in court. You're putting me on trial and you're making me prove my worth to you. Prove that I'm adequate enough for you or prove that I'm better than you. And I think we do this all the time. We size people up. We put them on trial. We decide right away based on what they're wearing or what they're saying or how they smell or whatever it is. We're deciding right away, is this person worthy of me? Accept, dismiss. Friend them, not friend them. Right? We're always doing this. It's exhausting for us and everyone around us. Paul says, you guys sized me up, you found me wanting. And that rejection's brutal because Paul planted the church. I'm going to go out and just tell you, it'd be hard for me. I planted One Harbor. It would be hard if this happened to me. And it would result in either just wandering around in despair like Eeyore, you know, for the rest of my life, or maybe even worse, pride to rise up in me to say, well, I was too good for you guys in the first place. Pride, despair. That's how we respond to stuff like this. Rejection, criticism brings out pride and despair in us. And the real thing, too, is that's kind of odd, is that affirmation, you know, people approving of you works like a drug, right? Once you've had a taste, you got to have more, right? You get addicted very easily to the praise of other people, very easily, right? You begin to live off that feeling of people liking you. Almost the worst thing that can happen to you is for you to get a bunch of likes on some photo you posted or something stupid like that. Because then you're in total fear. I mean, at one point you thought, no one cares about me. I can say whatever I want. Well, then everyone starts to like you. You're like, oh, I got to do that again. That felt great, right? That feeling of like, I've got to keep it. You know? Someone like me, I want to keep that feeling. Paul says, nope. It's a small thing what you guys think of me. I'm not going to get my identity based on what you think of me. And some of us are like, yeah, Paul, that's me too. In fact, that's why I picked One Harbor, because I don't care what anybody thinks about me. Right? It'd be odd, but anyway. I'm gonna say, yeah, Paul, that's right. Who cares what everybody thinks? So before we rush off and think we've already got this already, I think a lot of times we think, okay, cool, I don't care what anybody thinks about me, but then we run to a very equally dangerous alternative. I had my brother in my house for the last 2 weeks because he's a very bad drug addict and he detoxed. And we were trying to get him to rehab, which we were able to take him this week to rehab. And, 20 plus years of being a drug addict. And now he's sober, but he's in my home. And it was just, you know, it's an exhausting feeling. But I noticed something right away that was kind of odd. Have you guys ever seen the movie Elf? You ever seen the movie Elf with Will Ferrell? he eats a lot of sugar. I felt like I was watching Elf in my house. My brother, I have never seen a human being consume as much sugar. It was 2 weeks of Halloween in my house. My adult brother just ate sugar, 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 sugar from morning till night. Go to bed, come up in the morning, he's drank 2 liters of soda and a giant bag of barbecue chips. Like, he just kept eating sugar. And it occurred to me, what he's doing is he's replacing the drug. He was on these drugs, and now he's on these drugs because he's fiending for these drugs. And so what I bring that up is not to just air the dirty laundry for you. It's to say that I think we do this all the time. We think, okay, so I lived for the approval of everybody else, so I'm going to run away from that feeling, that high, and I'm going to run over here to this extreme where I'm going to live based on my own approval. And some of you have said, I don't care what anybody thinks. It's just about what I think. And I want to just propose to you, that's equally dangerous. It's equally dangerous to live off what you think. It's what a lot of us do, though. But it's very different than what Paul does. I mean, we've all been told to do it. Listen to your voice, to your own self be true. Listen to, you know, just listen to yourself, love yourself. That's the answer, right? Don't care about what any people think, just what you think about yourself. Paul says, he says something very different. He says, I'm not gonna let my identity be shaped by what you think about me, but I am also not gonna judge myself. Paul says, I'm not gonna let you put me in court, but you know what? I'm not gonna put myself in court either. I'm not going to put myself on trial either. And I wonder sometimes if that's not worse. I think we can sometimes be a worse judge of ourselves than other people. I mean, think about this. Think about the last time you did something stupid. You all have done something stupid recently. Even if you don't think you have, I'm your pastor. It's my job to tell you the truth. You've done something stupid recently. Just think about it. Think about how much time you spent. You probably spent a moment doing something stupid. Think about how long you spent beating yourself up for doing that stupid thing again. I said that again. I did that again. I can't believe I did that again. We're vicious on ourselves. You know, the hardest time for me is on like a Sunday afternoon like today. It'd be very hard for me, really, let's just be honest. Sunday afternoon, Sunday night into Monday, sometimes even Tuesday, I'm analyzing all the things I said up here. I'm like, oh, I said that. Oh, I did that. I can't believe I did that. Emailing the guys, is it too late to edit it offline? I don't want it on there. I mean, just that feeling or worse probably, I feel like I knock it out of the park and I live on this weird sense of a high on myself. It's bad for us to judge ourselves. Pride, despair, up, down, up, down. Here's the first. I'm gonna now quote Madonna. And for the new folks in the church, I'd like to tell you that this kind of stuff never happens, but it happens all the time. So. But anyway, I mean, when I was a kid, Madonna was a real culture shaper, and you know, I was in church, and so what I did was, you know, we demonized her all the time, and then I kind of just faked it everywhere I went. And this honesty that she brings to the table here is amazing, amazing. Listen to this. She says, "My drive in life comes from the fear of being mediocre. That's always pushing me. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, but then I feel I'm still mediocre and uninteresting unless I do something else. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and I guess it never will." Well, thank you, Madonna, for being very honest, more honest than a lot of us. Now, I'm not saying, everybody go out, follow Madonna, listen to Madonna, right? Cue the emails and the Facebook posts and all the rest. I'm saying, listen to her honesty and have a look at yourself. Does that describe your life? Never satisfied? I'm mediocre. I'm uninteresting. Oh, I'm a person. I'm worthy. Oh, I'm mediocre. I'm uninteresting. I got to do something else. Up, down, up, down. What Madonna's saying is, I'm in the courtroom. I'm on trial. It doesn't matter how many of you guys buy my music. It doesn't matter how many magazines I'm on. It doesn't matter how many awards I win. It doesn't matter how much money I have. I am still in the courtroom, and I guess I always will be. I'm always going to be on trial. It's never enough. See, that's the thing. It's not enough to tell yourself you're somebody because your ego is never satisfied. Because you'll get that thing that you thought if you got that or won that or achieved that, you'd be somebody, and you'll get it. And while you're holding the trophy in the back of your head, your ego will be saying, not yet. I've arrived. I wouldn't go that far. Not yet. It's never satisfied. So if it's you that you're gonna like be true to yourself and just listen to your own voice, you're gonna keep going too. It's never gonna be enough for you. And so Paul denies the courtroom altogether. That's what's so different. He's not saying, I just don't care what you guys think. I'm going to live for me. He says, I don't care what I think either. This is what's so radically different. I am not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted, verse 4. My conscience is clear. I can't think of anything that I would be stand guilty for on trial, but it doesn't mean I'm in the right. I don't get to be my own judge, Paul says. Because Paul's being honest. We know this to be true. You can do a horrible thing and not feel horrible about it. I bet Hitler slept pretty good at night. I mean, you've seen these documentaries of these serial killers doing horrible, awful things, and they thought they were doing the right thing. They thought they were helping the cause. You can do a horrible thing and not feel horrible about it. That's why you can't be your own judge. So Paul said, look, I'm not going to go in the courtroom. I'm not going to let a low view of myself deflate me. I'm not going to let a positive view of myself puff me up. Paul knew about his sins. He said, I'm the chief of sinners. He wrestled with sin, but he didn't let that deflate him. He also knew he was really gifted. And the guy wrote like 2/3 of the New Testament. He planted churches and broke up in cities all over the known world. He was an absolute machine. You know what? He didn't let any of that go to his head. We don't act like Paul, though. I think we act like the Corinthians. Judging others, letting others judge us, judging ourselves. We do good, we feel good. We do bad, we feel bad. Up, down, up, down. Most of us have probably been on a roller coaster. The thing about those roller coasters that makes them awesome is how short they last, right? They're over really quick, and you're like, I did it. I'm glad it's over, right? Imagine 25, 35, 55 years of it. It just never stops. Guys, I think I'm describing what a lot of life feels like for many of us. This roller coaster that just won't quit. Up, 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 down. Up, 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 down. We live in the courtroom. We live on the roller coaster. It's hard and it's exhausting, and God help us, we turn church into the courtroom too. A bunch of puffer fish inflating in ourselves so we can deflate others. So Jesus speaks of this in Luke 18. He says this religious guy who comes into church, this Pharisee comes into church, and he stands by himself and he prays, God, I thank you, I'm not like other men. See, if you are praying that, you're off to a bad start, okay? Thank you, I'm not like other men. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, and then he goes, or even this tax collector. I mean, he's thinking about a guy in the room with him. A literal person in the room, not conceptual bad people out there. This guy is in the same room praying to the same God. He's like, thank you, I'm not like this guy. Corey, he's a hot mess. Thank God I'm not like him. I tell you, I know I got problems, but not like Corey. Lord, you got your work cut out for him. Part the Red Sea, but good luck with Corey. Thank God I'm not like him. That's what a pufferfish does. That's what we act like in church. Paul's not like that. He's free from all that. That's what Tim Keller calls the blessed freedom of self-forgetfulness. Well, what we're saying here is that the goal is to be set free from constantly thinking about yourselves and others, and what everybody thinks about you. And really, that's what, if C.S. Lewis talks about like pride that drives the comparison, really what we're talking about getting to is a place of real humility. True humility, and C.S. Lewis speaks of that too. He says to even get near humility, even for a moment, is like a drink of cold water to a man in a desert. It's for a second to taste of humility. Do not imagine if you met a really humble man, he would be what most people today call humble. He will not be the sort of greasy, smarmy person who's always telling you that, of course, he's a nobody. It's not Eeyore. That's not what we're talking about. Probably all you would think about him is that he seemed cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you had to say. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. He goes on and says, you know, the humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. That's what a humble person looks like. They're not really thinking about themselves. They're genuinely interested in what you have to say. Some of you just hearing that's possible, your back just straightened up a little bit. Just the thought that you could be out from underneath this crushing weight what everybody thinks about you all the time. You know, the ego is that organ that's just inflated, it's drawing attention to itself. What if it was so healthy we never thought about it? Think about it. There's organs in your body you've never, ever thought about. You probably know they're there because they're working fine. What if our ego was like that? You never thought about it. You never thought to look to see who liked what you said or posted because you don't care. You're on there just so you can like everybody else's stuff. That looks delicious, right and left. What if we were like that? It kind of seems like a fantasy, doesn't it? What if when we got criticized, we were like, hang on, can you say that again? I think I'm at a moment right now where I've got a chance to grow. I want you to say it nice and slow. Can you write it down? I want to get all of it because I want to be a better person. No, say it again. I want to hear it. What if we weren't up all night long with pride, despair? You, who are you? Who are they to say that? Oh, you think you're something? Like, what if we weren't? What if we didn't do that when we got criticized? We're like, man, thank you so much. I'm going to go think about that. It's probably true, and I'd like to be better. You would think someone's a crazy person and would only think like that, right? I am not saying that I am the Jedi master of this. It hurts when people criticize me, and it feels too good when people say nice things. But I am getting better by the grace of God. It hurts less. I take criticism less personal, and I let praise go to my head less than it used to. I'm getting better by God's grace. I didn't spend 36 years of my life living off this stuff. It's not going to go away overnight. But I want to say to you guys, God wants to heal us of this stuff. He wants to change. He doesn't want us to be trapped like this. The goal isn't to be self-hating or even self-loving. The goal is just to be self-forgetful. Ego is just so healthy, it doesn't even think about itself. How do we do this? Well, I think we find the hope for this in verse 1. This is how one should regard us. Here's how I want you to think about us, Paul says. Servants of Christ, stewards of the mystery of God. The problem is our ego is puffed up. The result is that we judge ourselves and everybody else. The solution is that we receive the verdict of the only one who matters. The only one who matters. What's Paul pulling to you? He says, look, think about me, but think about like what Jesus has done for me, because that's how I'm going to think about me. Who's Jesus and what has he done for me, right? I'm just a servant. I'm just a steward. Those are very modest titles for yourself. Paul could have said, when you think about me, don't you think about I'm the guy who started this church. That's what you better think of. You better show some respect. I'm the guy who's writing all these books of the Bible people are going to be reading for the next thousands of years. Now Paul says, I'm a servant. I'm a steward. But I'm a steward of the gospel, the mystery of God revealed, the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. I am a servant of Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world. So what's Paul saying here? He's not acting like Eeyore. I'm just a nobody. No, he says, man, my identity is not found in me. It's found in him. I'm a steward, I'm a servant, but man, I'm a steward of him, his mystery, a servant of him. He's not trying to make himself something he's not. Remember that little back and forth in the office where Dwight was, you know, he would always introduce himself as the assistant regional manager, and then Michael Scott would say assistant to the regional manager. It was this back and forth all the time through the whole thing. It's because that's how we act all the time. We're always trying to make ourselves look better than we are, something more than we are. And Paul said, I'm not going to do that. My confidence is not found in me and my title. My confidence is found in him and his title. Who he is enough. I can find my identity in him. If your identity is in you, it's just a never-ending battle. Never enough. Never. If it's in other people, it's exhausting. What did you think? What did you think? What did you think? What did you think? Oh, you didn't like it? Oh, I'll try better next time. If it's in him, only his opinion matters. And I think, sadly, for a lot of Christians, We think Jesus is like all those kids in middle school. Never enough for Jesus. Oh, he's always disappointed. We turn Christianity into the same exhausting rat race. But the verdict is in regarding what Jesus thinks. And it's not based on your performance or mine. It's based on his. That's the gospel. Paul says it's the Lord who judges me. I can't make myself innocent. But that word innocent is the same word, acquitted. It's the same word that he uses in Romans 3 where he says, all have sinned, all of us have sinned and fall short, way short of the glory of God and are justified. That word is acquitted, made innocent, made righteous. We are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. This is the big aha moment that I want you just to lean in for, right? Paul says, don't look for the verdict in the courtroom of your opinion or the opinion of other people. It's always changing and it's harsh and it's brutal. Don't look for it there. Look to the unchanging opinion of God who matters, the one who matters, right? But know that in the gospel, the verdict has already come in and it's come to us by grace. We've been made innocent and it's a gift. It's a total gift. None of us can boast because none of us has earned it, right? Every other way of looking at life, every other religion on the planet, every other philosophy on the planet is going to say the same thing. Stay in the courtroom and try to prove yourself to the very end. The dying words of the Buddha were, strive without ceasing. But the dying words of Jesus hanging on a cross are, it is finished, right? It is the only thing in the world that is different. Everything says, try harder, do better, try harder. And Jesus says, rest in me. Rest in me. Christianity is not, fingers crossed, we'll do the best we can, go to church, give a lot, hope someday we're going to find out we were approved by God, see light at the end of a tunnel, maybe. And we've got to stop talking like that because that is not Christianity. That's everything else on the planet. No, no, no. The gospel is Jesus died to save us, to make us right with God, to make us his own, to give us new identity in him. And he approves of us based on what he's done, not based on what we could do. And so we get off the roller coaster. We leave the courtroom. We stop putting ourselves and other people on it. Why? Why can we rest? Why don't we have to be in the courtroom anymore? Because Jesus went to the courtroom for us. Jesus went on trial in our place. We were guilty. We deserved the courtroom and we were going to be found wanting. But Jesus went for us in our place. He went into the courtroom, the perfect one, the innocent one, the righteous one, the special one. I mean, he's existed for all time. Talk about an interesting human being. And he became nothing. Your worst nightmare is to be rejected. My worst nightmare is to be rejected. He was rejected by everybody. He was betrayed. He was spit on. He was mocked. He was beaten. He was hung naked on a shameful cross. He did that. The perfect one, the righteous one did that. He went on trial and he was murdered for us. So that we didn't have to live in the courtroom anymore. That we had to face the guilty verdict so that we could be set free. He was utterly rejected as our substitute. And then we look to him, the Savior. And we find approval. And we find the verdict and the only opinion that matters. So let me ask you, if you're here, I know not all of us in this room are Christians, but if you're here and you are a Christian, can you tell me if you honestly believe Jesus suffered and died in your place and took the shame he took and went to trial for you and faced what he faced, do you honestly think it makes any sense in the world for you to lose sleep over people who didn't like, say happy birthday to you on Facebook? I know that's a silly example, but I'm telling you, it's that kind of nonsense that we're feeding on every day. Did they like it? Did they not? Did they like it? Did they not? Little kids would like the flower, like she likes me, she doesn't. That's what we're living like. And the Savior of the world, the King of all ages, came and did what he did for us. And we're like, oh, we believe it. We're gonna sing about it. You know what we're gonna do? We're gonna base our whole life on what everyone else thinks about us. We know you approve of us. Yeah, okay. It doesn't make any sense. So as we consider how to respond this morning, if you're here and you're not yet a Christian, first of all, man, I think it's courageous that you come to church. I don't take that for granted. I mean, if I was in your situation, this would be a big step for me. Come to a church meeting. But I hope you've been helped by this. I want to say a couple things to you as you just consider what to do next for those of you who aren't yet Christians. I wanted to say that the church is not meant to be. I know it can be, but it's not meant to be just another place in the world where you come to posture like a puffer fish. Just like the gym, you better like flex and, you know, wear the right thing and, you know, stand everybody down and look better than everyone. That's not at all what church should be like. It really shouldn't. This is where you could come and just because we're all in here together admitting something. We can't save ourselves. We need someone else. And it's freedom that comes. We take our eyes off ourselves, our eyes off each other. We fix our eyes on him. There's an old book, Pilgrim's Progress, that really gets to this. I'll read you a little portion of this. And I want to just say, I want to just ask you, if you're here and you're not yet a Christian, consider that this is what I think coming to Christianity would look like for you. This man, his name is Christian, the character in the story. He's dealt with a lot of anxiety and fear and stress. He's been on this long road trying to make it on his own. And he comes to this pivotal moment. He ran thus till he came to a place somewhat ascending. And upon that place stood a cross, a little blowout in the bottom, a tomb or a sepulcher. I saw in my dream that just as Christian came up with the cross, his burden loosed from off his shoulders. This weight he'd been carrying fell from off his back, began to tumble, and so continued to do so until it came to the mouth of that sepulcher, that tomb, where it fell in, and I saw it no more. Then was Christian glad and lightsome and said with a merry heart, "He has given me rest by his sorrow and life by his death." Then he stood still a while to look and wonder, for it was very surprising to him that the sight of the cross should thus ease him from his burden. He looked therefore and looked again, even till the springs that were in his head sent the waters down his cheeks. Then Christian gave three leaps of joy and went on singing, "Thus far did I come laden with my sin, nor could aught ease the grief that I was in till I came hither. What place is this? Must here be the beginning of my bliss? Must here be the burden fall from my back? Must here the streams that bound it to me crack? Blessed cross, blessed sepulcher, blessed rather be the man that there was put to shame for me." This life of trying to do better and try harder and do better, he probably brought you to church. You thought, here's the place where you can learn how to do better and try harder. We're telling you that's not what this is. It's coming to realizing we can never do enough, we can never try enough. But Jesus has done it for us. And when we fix our eyes on him, the burden that we've been carrying our whole life just falls away. Like my brother, you're guilty. We're guilty. But the judge has done the unthinkable. We had a good judge last week. He was kind, but he was nothing like this judge. This judge who happily came down and stood in our place. Jesus the righteous. And his message to not is we better not go screw up, or you know what's gonna happen. We'll throw you right back in jail. Now he says, "Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest." So that's the invitation for you if you're not yet a Christian. Get off the roller coaster. Get out of the courtroom. Stop trying to save yourself. Stop the roller coaster of pride and despair and just trust Jesus. Surrender to Jesus. If you're here and you're already a Christian, we're going to take communion here in a minute. And this is great. Here's the thing. We say that we know all this already. I mean, if we took a test at the beginning, I said, "Okay, guys, you can leave the room if you get the right answer on this test. You don't have to stay for this next part." You know, those are always the best moments in school. Multiple choice, you know, A, B, C. So whose opinion matters is the question. A, other people. B, your opinion. C, Jesus. You know, we'd all pick C. Because we know, one, you always pick C if you guys are still in school. And two, because we know in our head, the Sunday school answer, we know it. Jesus, he's right, he's it. So we know it in our head, but we do not believe it in our heart. Because we are still in the courtroom, many of us in this room. He has set us free. We had to go back to the courtroom, me and my brother, because he had to have a DNA swab done. And it was so interesting, having left, having to go back in. He didn't want to. Actually, we said to the lady, kind of made a joke. We said, "Hey, look, don't take this personal, but we're not trying to stay here very long." Once you've left the court, you're not trying to go back. You don't want to go back in there. But y'all, Jesus has set us free, and we're living in the daggone courtroom and dragging everybody else in there. And Jesus doesn't want that for you. Do not die on the cross so you and I can stay in the courtroom judging ourselves and judging others. So as you guys consider, my friends in the room who are Christians, as you consider this morning coming and taking communion, remember what Jesus said, "Do this in remembrance of me. My body broken for you, my blood shed for you." Jesus certainly did not go through that so we could live like this to ourselves and others. Take a minute and just pray and just let the gospel call you out of the courtroom. Let it show you where you're doing that to yourself and other people. And ask Jesus to set you free from, to heal your ego. Stop thinking about yourself so much. Focus on what matters the most, his opinion. Jesus, we pray that you would be with us now as we look to respond. You know how easy it is for us to do that. Your own disciples were like this. who's the greatest, and just constant, this constant comparison and competition. And so many of us in this room have been really hurt. Ego's deflated. Maybe we've always been the butt of all the jokes. Maybe we've lived with a crushing sense of everyone thinks we're perfect, we better stay that way. Man, it's hard. A lifelong roller coaster that you died and rose again to set us free from. Jesus, be with us now. Help us, Lord. Holy Spirit, come and show us where we think like this and act like this and set us free. Heal our ego. For my friends in the room who don't yet know you, Jesus, I pray that you would draw close to them now. Feel an overwhelming sense of just emotion as they realize that they have been carrying a burden that is heavy. There's no end in sight, but you want to set them free. What you think of them is what really matters, and there's grace and there's mercy available because of what you've done. We could never be good enough, but you were. You were good enough. Be with us now, Jesus.